every year we try to put on the schedule a discussion about new raw materials. And in the midst of a very thrilling meeting with the American Association of Plant Food Control Officials, where we go to make sure we don't get surprised with new regulations or rulemaking, I heard a presentation by a company called Mycorrhizal Applications LLC. And it was one of the best presentations I've ever heard on that topic. And he was trying to tell a bunch of state regulators about it, the product and what it does, et cetera. And it was the most succinct and beautiful presentation. And I said, that's wonderful. And I looked around the room and they're all going, right, like that. And I said, we need to know more about this, and particularly more before they do. We have with us today Jeff Anderson, who represents Mycorrhizal Applications LLC from Grants Pass, Oregon. He's traveled all the way here to be with us today to talk about their company and their products and this whole product line of mycorrhizal inoculants that can be used for a variety of topics and even mulch. You know, there are applications for mulch and soil. And we had a rather extensive discussion about that at APCO. And Jeff has got extensive training in this area, and we've been corresponding back and forth on it. And he's got a lot of information to present, so we need to move along. So, Jeff, please join us and explain to us what it is you do and why we should know about this.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to thank the Mulch and Soil Council for allowing us to share information that is really the product of about 40 years of research and development by Dr. Mike Amaranthus and our company, Mycorrhizal Applications. As Bob mentioned, he met Dr. Mike at a recent conference, so I think you had a cancellation, and appreciate you allowing us to come share this information. So we're going to talk about beneficial soil microorganisms, particularly the mycorrhizal fungi. And it's pretty amazing that we know more about the celestial bodies above our heads than the soil beneath our feet. And that soil beneath our feet is what sustains our lives and our livelihoods. Research over time, you know, there's a lot going on in the soil that we don't understand. The most studied organisms are the bacteria and the mycorrhizal fungi. And we identify and see a lot of things in the soil, at least 70 different processes, that we really don't understand yet. So this is really a growing and interesting field. I've been with Mycorrhizal Applications since they started 18 years ago. And we've been very fortunate in that our company has grown, and we're now really expanding worldwide in agriculture. And so my job now in Grants Pass is to work more with industries such as soil and mulch manufacturers, turf, horticulture, and so forth, parts of the business that we've really neglected for some time. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. And as I mentioned, 20 years ago, we started a small company. And today, or I would say prior to March 1st, before we were acquired by Valent Biosciences, we were a company of about 25 persons. Since March 1st, we joined Valent Biosciences in Libertyville, Illinois, which does businesses in 95 countries worldwide. And it was really exciting for me because the passion for Dr. Mike and I from the beginning was to get these materials out in the world where they could change people's lives and people would have access to them, particularly in agriculture where we get more nutrition and food and reduce inputs. So it's been a really exciting trip, and I'm honored to be here today to share the information with you guys and your industries and how these might improve your products, add value to your products, and get these materials out in landscapes and the world to improve soil conditions, reduce inputs, and so forth. So we're going to kind of go through and share, first of all, what mycorrhiza is. How many people have heard of mycorrhiza and know what mycorrhiza is? Okay, well, that's better than 20 years ago, where nobody raised their hand. So, essentially, mycorrhiza literally means fungus root. So it's a fungus that attaches to a plant root, expanding the plant root's access to the soil, moisture, and resources, and translocates those minerals, nutrients, and water back into the plant for superior growth. So it's a true symbiotic relationship where the plant gets simple sugars and carbohydrates from the fungi, and in return, the fungi returns minerals and nutrients to the plant to fuel its activities and productivity. I guess what I'll start with is I'm just going to do a brief visualization exercise and just ask everybody just to close their eyes for a minute and just capture a mental image of your favorite plant. And it can be a crop plant, it can be a tree, it can be flowers in your yard, your favorite ornamental. And just get a mental image and picture that plant and take a second and just look at it. And then I'll ask you to open your eyes. And how many people saw the root system of that plant? Okay, and that's what we're going to talk about today, because the plant spends about 50 to 70% of its energy on below ground processes, which is the root system. 460 million years ago, aquatic plants found their way onto the Earth's surface, and they did that with this fortuitous relationship between the fungus and the plant root. So the mycorrhizal fungi got into the aquatic plant and gave the aquatic plants the tools to colonize the harsher surface. And so it's really fundamental to our existence, because obviously if we didn't have land plants, we wouldn't have food, we wouldn't be here. You could actually go back in the Devonian fossil records and see these mycorrhizal structures in those fossils. So we call it one of nature's longest and most successful experiments, and the original World Wide Web. And you can see why we call it the original World Wide Web. Here we have a tree seedling, and you can see the traditional taproot structure and ground of the root. Everything else in this picture is the mycorrhiza, which is the fungal extension of the root system. And the entire surface area of this structure can actually excrete enzymes and chemicals that break down all 15 micro and macronutrients and translocate it back through the tips and the attachment points at the end of this root system. Typically, a plant without a mycorrhizal root system, minerals and nutrients are only going to be available at the root tip where there's a membrane, if they're there and if they're in a form available to the plant to uptake and utilize. So it's a real powerful network and extension of the plant root system. We're going to talk a little bit today, a little form and function to these things, what they are, where they are, where they're not, how they live, how to use them, how not to use them, and maybe how to utilize them in your materials to make your materials better and work better and produce better plants, certainly. Today in nurseries, they come out in sterile medias, and the plants really have a lot of water roots. They don't have the fine feeder roots that you're really looking for a plant to do well in outplanting. There are nurseries now starting to inoculate in nurseries. Someday, I would suspect all plants that come for nurseries will have mycorrhizae already on the root systems. So now it's really important in soil medias, in nursery mixes and so forth, potting soils and so forth, to allow the consumer and home gardeners and planters to take advantage of these for superior growth, performance, and survival. You look back at these natural ecosystems, and over 90% of the world's terrestrial plants form this mycorrhizal fungi for survival, sufficient nutrient water uptake. Some plants are so dependent on mycorrhiza, they can't grow or live without it. Others are less dependent on mycorrhiza, and then there's others that don't require mycorrhiza, as we'll see. Fortunately, a lot of those are the weed species, which in agriculture is a big deal. So, how did nature do it? And really, this isn't rocket science. What we've done is we've taken the template from nature. You look here in an old growth forest, and you have redwood trees that are 300 feet tall, they're 1,000 years old. Nobody watered them, nobody fertilized them. nobody used insecticides or pesticides. You look across the landscape, you don't see disease. So how, you know, what's the message? The message is when you have diversity of soil biology, nature keeps things on a balance and keeps disease out. You've got a self-fertilizing system from detritus and healthy complex soils. The soil holds is a carbon sink, and there's very little erosion and nutrient loss in systems like this. It's utilized by the mycorrhizal fungi and this complex microbial environment. As you noticed in that mycorrhizal picture, a plant that has a mycorrhizal root system in times of environmental stress is going to do a lot better than a plant that is non-mycorrhizal. As an example here, you see a typical seedling, it's maybe a sterile media, you don't have mycorrhiza. And you can see with mycorrhiza, you would imagine if it got cold or there were environmental extremes, that a plant with that kind of foundation and root system would do a lot better. And that, in fact, is what happens. And it's really nice because there are over 100,000 studies now on mycorrhizal fungi documenting the benefits in terms of drought tolerance, disease resistance, nutrient acquisition, etc. We're going to share some of those with you. For tens of thousands of years in natural environments, these meadows were very productive ecosystems. And that is because of the natural balance of soil biology and the mycorrhizal fungi. So if we compare natural ecosystems to disturbed ecosystems, which would be, you know, our urban environments and agriculture and so forth, basically we spend a lot of time moving soil and disturbing soils. So in natural environments, they're teeming with life, the nutrients are in organic forms, there's very little leaching losses, they have deep aerobic zones, little disease pressure, and requires very little inputs to maintain productivity. Mycorrhizae, I should mention, are also the carbon decomposers. So, you know, in mulches and compost, when they break them down and digest them, they create food sources that increase root growth and root exudates and root activity, which are the chemicals that stimulate the mycorrhizal spores to germinate and form the relationship with the plant. In disturbed environments, we term them biologically challenged. Nutrients are typically in chemical forms. There's considerable leaching losses. There's thin aerobic zones, severe disease pressure, and increasing inputs to maintain productivity. Obviously, in soils and mulches and in plant growth, we know that water and air are the two most critical elements for plant growth. Challenges to mycorrhiza. Obviously, soil excavation and tillage. You know, we have a symbiotic relationship with a plant. If there's no plants and there's disturbance, you're ripping these hyphal webs apart. There's no food source for these organisms. Extended periods of fallow, soil fumigation, isolation from natural mycorrhizal sources. You know, productive forests, and I'm going to talk about the different types of mycorrhiza and how naturally they can occur and get into your products or into your soils. Erosion, fungicides, chemical fertilizers, and compaction, which is a big deal. As we talk about air and water, you know, you compress the air out of soil, and plants have a very difficult time growing. And then, as I mentioned, some plants are non-mycorrhizal or have a very low dependency. And in soilless medias and nursery mixes, typically devoid of a lot of soil biology. So nature has this really interesting pattern of distribution and allocation of resources. And on the left here, you see the leaf of a plant. And a small leaf, and you see all these little pathways for photosynthesis and minerals and nutrients to move through the plant. Here we have the human heart, where blood is transferred out into the body. Here we have the basin of the Amazon in this river network. So this is a pattern that is reoccurring in nature. And I think you would agree that when you see that mycorrhiza, you see the same type of network that nature utilizes for allocation and distribution of resources. I think we can liken it to this cotton ball as an extension of a root system. You can see how fine the fiber is and how much more root surface area is being added to the plant. And particularly when this actually excretes chemicals that break down minerals and nutrients and bring them back to the plant. On the left, we have a non-mycorrhizal plant that can only get minerals and nutrients from the root tips of the plants. And here what we've done is we've colonized those root tips and greatly expanded this hyphal network to scour the soil's volume and resource for minerals and nutrients, break them down, and get them into the plant. This is a picture of the little hyphal web. And in natural and undisturbed environments, you can have miles of these filaments in even a spoonful of soil. So you can see how small they are. They're about a 25th the size of a human hair. So here's the tip. In this case, it's a conifer tree. And you've got these little pasta-like structures coming out from the root tip, and they're scouring the soil resource. Hundreds of these things called hyphae grow out into the soil from each feeder root, and they originate inside the colonized cortical root cells of the plant. The hyphae are about the 25th diameter of a human hair and go out a couple feet out into the soil. They're able to absorb nutrients and water along their entire length, unlike a plant root. And then they are transferring that into the plant's vascular system. They produce these powerful enzymes to break down these tied up soil nutrients and non-soluble compounds. We've done a lot in agriculture, and a number of years ago when fossil fuel prices went up 400 or 500%, farmers were calling and saying, I can't keep affording to fertilize my fields, I want to try your material. And they did. And at the end of that year, they got yields that were better than they'd ever had before without adding any fertility. And the answer was a lot of that fertility that they've been paying for and putting out in their fields, first of all, a lot of it volatilized into the atmosphere. A lot of it was still out there in a warehouse of fertility that the non-mycorrhizal plants couldn't get at and access. As soon as they added the mycorrhizal component, they were mining all this material that they had paid for years and got into their plants. Obviously, I said, well, that's not a self-sustaining system. You have to keep adding into that system. But it really showed the colors of the mycorrhiza and their ability to get at these things. These filaments are also the primary means by which the fungi reproduce. They grow through the soil and touch other roots from the same plant or other plants and quickly colonize those as well. So we've done plantings in landscape where we put in two or three rows of flowers that are colonized, and you can literally watch a wave of color and vigor just roll down a bed to the non-inoculated plants. It's pretty spectacular. And being the non-scientist, when I came to mycorrhizal applications, I hadn't really seen this, and I'll show you some trials that I was involved in that kind of cemented my belief and interest in mycorrhiza. So this is the endomycorrhizal structures. This is the root here. This is an arbuscule, and an arbuscule, as you'll see a picture of one, they call it an arbuscule because it's arbor-shaped. It looks like a tree. And it's the exchange mechanism where the simple sugars and carbohydrates from the plant are exchanged for minerals and nutrients from the fungus. And there's little storage structures here called vesicles. We're going to talk about those in terms of drought tolerance. And then the hyphae comes out of the plant, this distributive hyphae that breaks down minerals and nutrients, absorptive hyphae that gets it and brings it back into the plant. And then on a later stage of maturity and development, you actually get spore production out into the soils. If they're out through a whole crop cycle or a plant cycle, you get these really durable structures, mycorrhizal structures. Here's an arbuscule. If you flip that upside down, you can see how it would look like a tree. And this is the exchange mechanism within the root that takes the simple sugars and carbohydrates and breaks them down and gets into the plant. And here's a cross-section of a root with the arbuscule at the root cell attachment site. You can kind of see that hyphae coming in there from the lower right. And this is where things take place. So clearly a very successful biological success story in the history of the Earth. On the left, the endomycorrhiza. On the right, a root tip of a Douglas fir, which turns out to be an ecto, like ectoskeletal. Mycorrhiza is endo, like endodontal, it's inside. We're going to talk a little bit about these two different types. And so imagine we've gone below the soil surface. And here we are traveling underground. And you can see some roots coming here, the mycorrhizal hyphae extending off of the roots, exploring tight areas in the soil. And then there's some minerals and nutrients that are in the soil. And the mycorrhizae produce enzymes, and they go and get these minerals and nutrients and translocate them back into the plant. So, you know, we refer to it often as the secret beneath your feet, because you never see it. We don't give soil biology a lot of thought, but it's very complex. So here you can see in a typical plant, you have the non-mycorrhizal root, and they have a peak depletion zone along the outside of the rhizosphere. And there's these pools of available phosphorus out in the soil, either were there naturally or added fertility. And here, with the addition of the mycorrhizal inoculation, you see the hyphae coming out and the adsorptive hyphae excreting chemicals, breaking it down into a soluble form, and then translocating it back into the plant for superior growth. The really exciting thing that we always knew about is how mycorrhizae gets its organic forms of nitrogen and brings it back into the plant. And a number of years ago, through a quantum dot biomedical technology, they were actually able to document the organic nitrogen coming through the mycorrhizal hyphae and into the plant. And this is something we always knew was happening, but we couldn't prove it until this new technology appeared. Here we have some hyphae in the soil, and you can literally see the nutrient flow and development of the hyphae actually growing through the soil. And you should see here in a second some of the materials within that. There you go. So here's your solubilized nutrients being pumped into the plant and forming this, you know, hyphal network scouring the soil. So that's really where the rubber meets the road. You can actually see these things before we just talked about them. The other neat thing about the mycorrhizal fungi as carbon decomposers is in the process of breaking down organic matter, they provide food sources for other bacteria and soil microbes. So you get these really complex environments like we saw out in the redwood forest, and it can be in your yard or anywhere over time when you don't disturb soils that you create this really nice biology that helps your plants grow and be disease resistant. There's a diagram with and without mycorrhizae. And typically in nature, I would say the biggest, and we don't make disease claims, but there's tons of university studies, you know, if you want to get EPA regulation, you know, you could put a lot of these on your materials probably. I think that costs about $7 million currently. But there are some claims that we're going to talk about that we do utilize. But, you know, I think we would all agree that in nature and in general, the best capacities that mycorrhizae bring for disease suppression are producing healthy plants. You know, nature isn't designed to send the garbage collectors out after healthy organisms. They go after ones that have insufficient diets or are somehow weakened. And those are the ones they go after first. So if you have this robust root system and this healthy plant that's getting all the trace minerals and nutrients, you know, you're going to have a healthier plant. So that's probably the number one disease suppressing mechanism that is a benefit of the mycorrhizal fungi. And we're going to see some others, specific ones. The endo or the arbuscular mycorrhizae, AM, forms with 80% of all land plants. There are some species, and one in particular in our base mixes that we use, that we've never seen not form with an endomycorrhizal plant. So these endos are very nonspecific as to what plants they will form with. But some species are better than others for certain characteristics, and we're going to share those with you. So endo and ecto account for 90% of all the plant families. And you can see the difference in the structure of these two different fungi. You've got the endomycorrhiza and the hyphae coming out here, and then you've got the root cortex being colonized by the ectomycorrhiza and the heart-shaped net and mantle. And this is really interesting. It actually provides a protective layer on the root, which helps with pathogens physically attacking the plant. but also for drought tolerance. They'll actually keep the root tips turgid during times of severe drought and low plant soil moisture regimes, and release it back to the plants. And that's why we get some of the other characteristics of drought tolerance. So, ectomycorrhizal fungi. This turns out to be a Piscilistis tinctoris, which is a fruiting body. And the other ectos occur as truffles, underground truffles, and that's what the squirrels did. We actually collect these in nature and utilize them in some of our inoculations for the forestry and landscape industries. Some sclerodermis, some rhizopogons, and the Piscilistis. This actually erupts above ground. This is the sporocarp. It opens up when it dries and releases spores aerially, so they get distributed. So if you're living near a forest, you typically will get some of these blowing on your property and benefiting your trees, your conifers. The endomycorrhizas you've seen are produced underground, and they're not aerially distributed. And that's the challenge. As you disturb landscapes, you know, these things just don't repopulate quickly. They're not aerially dispersed. You have to put them there if you want to. Here's an example of the ectomycorrhizal fungi colonizing a plant. And what's really important to mention is that the mycorrhiza actually causes a bifurcation of the root. So you actually morphologically change the structure of the root, which is a big deal. If you branch the root, especially if you inoculate a plant early on in the growth cycle, you can use very little mycorrhizal material to accomplish that, so it's very affordable. And you create a different root structure that then gets colonized by the hyphae, and the plant is going to have just a better structure and chance of survival. Ecto, as I mentioned, are the conifer trees, with the exception of redwood and cedar, which are endomycorrhizal. There are some plants that form both ways, like willow and alder, form both endo and ecto. It's a small group. There's orchidaceae and ericaceous plants that do not form with endo or ecto, which are the common mycorrhizas. Typically, these mycorrhizas, if you can find them commercially, you know, they've got stability issues that, you know, they're not as stable as the endos and the ectos, which are very durable. Some of the plants that don't respond to the endos and ectos would be your sedges, rush spinach, your cruciferous vegetables, your brassicas, and so forth. So, you know, it wouldn't hurt them, but if that were all you were growing, you wouldn't inoculate them, because it would be a waste of material. Rhododendrons and blueberries are ericaceous. And then, as I mentioned, many of the weed species are non-mycorrhizal, and they like disturbed areas, and that's probably why. Some of the benefits we're going to look at here. One is this improved root development. I talked about this bifurcation and branching of the fine feeder roots. These are the type of, this was a trial we did down in Australia. And, you know, I always wondered how far can roots go, you know. And then my first year of college, I was at UC San Diego, and I was down there in the cliffs on the beach. And there were grasses that were going, the root systems were 80 feet down because they were in the sand. They had air and water. So as long as you have air and water, you can get this kind of root growth. And particularly if you add the mycorrhizal fungi, it's pretty dramatic. So here are a variety of different endomycorrhizal spores under a microscope. And it's important to know that these are wonderful biological critters, the bacteria are wonderful, but they're not as durable as the mycorrhiza. We've seen spores come out of snowbanks up in Wisconsin that are 10,000 years old and are virtually beautiful and viable. They only break dormancy in contact with a living plant root or in proximity to a living plant root. So specific chemical exudates from those roots that cause these spores to germinate and form the relationship with the plant. So in terms of utilizing them in bagged products and having them on shelves for retail and so forth, we're very fortunate that they have that kind of durability. They're also not sensitive to UV if you were spraying them on mulches and so forth. And I would imagine a lot of the mulches are used as landscape covers, but there is the opportunity to put a liquid spray on those, and in a rain event or during irrigation, have those wash off those mulches and drop down into the soil profile where the roots are, be germinated and formed with the plants in that landscape.
Jeff, what about higher temperatures? You mentioned the cold.
That's a good question. I had it here in my notes because Bob was very good at doing a list of things he wanted to make sure I covered, and I didn't want to miss that, so thanks for asking. Really, the only things that seem to disturb mycorrhizal fungi are high temperatures over 140 degrees Fahrenheit for prolonged periods of time. And the reason for that is you can see there's a little protoplasmic oils and material inside these spores. And if you heat them up and they boil and they fracture the cell wall, they're no longer efficacious. So, you know, there are people putting these in pellets and manufacturing processes and running them through dryers and so forth. And, you know, really, for a short period of time, it's fine as long as that parent material doesn't get over 140 degrees. And one of the other questions that Bob had is, you know, how do you verify that these things are in products and that they're viable? And the ultimate way is you then take something that you've exposed to high temperature or product, and you plant a plant in it, and you grow that plant out, and then you look inside the plant roots and determine the MIP, which is the mycorrhizal infection percentage of the plant. And you can then take it, centrifuge those spores out, and we can taxonomically identify those species, and DNA, we can identify those mycorrhizae as having come from our company. So that's one way. You can certainly look in soils and see mycorrhizae, but you don't really know ultimately how, you know, they can look good and they're probably going to be viable, but until you actually put it in association with a living plant host and look at the degree of colonization, do you know how effective your product is. And so anybody developing a product that uses the heat process, obviously that's the first thing you want to explore is, once we've got a finished product, you know, how's it going to do in the real world and how well is it going to colonize plants. Here is a spore germination signal. You see the spore out there, and it senses the plant root exudates and germinates and sends these little hyphae over to the plant and starts colonizing inside the plant. And the nice thing about mycorrhiza is once a plant has been colonized by mycorrhizal fungi, that plant is a mycorrhizal plant for the rest of its life cycle. This is not a fertilizer. This is if you do it appropriately and you get it in contact with the roots and that plant gets colonized, you're done. And that's fantastic in, you know, obviously landscapes. We have a lot of perennials. Obviously in agriculture, that's typically not the case, but for someone, say, growing alfalfa and you inoculate a plant and it's out there for 7 or 8 years, $10 an acre, you know, divides by 7, so very affordable. And when you can reduce inputs of water and fertility by 30%, which we're going to talk about, it obviously pays for itself many times over. So why bother with these soil, with soil organisms in general? But the mycorrhizae, they create soil structure. We're going to see how they do that. They conserve and access soil nutrients. We've talked about that. A robust living soil prevents diseases. We've alluded to that. Soil organisms protect against stress events. Soil organisms reduce input maintenance costs, are more sustainable and increase plant performance, and they're going to make your products better. We work with a lot of people that put our materials in their products, so they don't tell anybody, and they don't put them on the label. They don't really want people to know, and they don't really care, because people use the products, they love the products, and they come back and buy their product, so they don't need to tell others. Some of the benefits, the improved establishment, growth and survival, nutrient uptake, drought tolerance. Mycorrhizal plants experience about 3 to 5 bars less plant moisture stress in a drought scenario, and we'll see examples of that. One from the University of Florida. They improve root development, parasitic nematode control. I have a little video to share with you that looks like a Japanese horror flick. It's pretty wild. And weed suppression. And the weed suppression comes in because weeds are non-mycorrhizal. So if you've inoculated your target crop with a mycorrhiza, it's going to grow quicker, it's going to block out weeds from sunlight and nutrients because it's taking advantage of the mycorrhiza and the weeds can't. And improve soil structure, which is a big one. And we're going to see how mycorrhiza produce. And this was a really amazing thing to learn about 8 years ago. Substance called glomalin. And that holds 30% of the world's carbon in the soil for up to 30 years. So really fascinating. In terms of establishment growth, what we see with mycorrhiza that produce ethylene is quick germination. So here's a golf course project, one of those expensive golf courses that doesn't want anybody to know what they're doing.
in the Pacific Northwest, and you can see out here without mycorrhiza, obviously the germination percentages are down, the cover, and certainly the speed at which germination and cover takes place is dramatic. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these mycorrhizal products in the golf and turf industries when they're trying to get tees and greens and fairways playable. In a quick way to get those green fees rolling in and to reduce water and fertility needs on golf courses and reducing disease pressure as a result of reducing chemical use. Now, when I first went to work with Dr. Mike 20 years ago, I should have been born in Missouri because I've got to see something to believe it. I've got to touch it. If I'm going to represent and sell it, I have to know that it works. So I started doing some trials. And this is a one without mycorrhizae and with mycorrhizae. Most people would look at this and say, that's snake oil, that's not possible. Well, I'm here to tell you it is possible because I've done these trials. Here's with marigolds. The first trial I did was for Jackson and Perkins Rose Company in Southern Oregon. And they produce about 6 million rose bushes a year. And I went to their location and I got the same cultivar, the same number of lateral branches, and I did a 25 replicate study applying mycorrhizae. I did it all myself. And this is what I saw every time: more lateral branching, earlier flowering, later flowering, more vigor, healthier plants. And I go, this is a no-brainer. I can do this. And here we are 20 years later. Example of snapdragons in a nursery with and without mycorrhizae. And sometimes what you see in plants really early on is the untreated will actually look like they're outperforming the mycorrhizal plant, and that's because the root systems are developing the hyphion. So all the energy is going into the colonization phase, and then as soon as that colonization phase starts developing the soil and that web starts taking advantage of applied nutrition, they just blow by the controls. Maples are a highly dependent mycorrhizal species, and that's why this is so dramatic. We do a lot of Japanese maples, horticulture, landscapes on the left, and then 2 months later, you can see just how vibrant and well-established the mycorrhiza has allowed these plants to become. More flowers, earlier flowers, later flowering. I've also seen that mycorrhizal flowers from a mycorrhizal plant actually last longer as cut flowers at my home. It's pretty amazing because they have more, trace minerals and nutrients in the flowers themselves, and so they persist and last longer after being cut. Improved water uptake and drought tolerance. This is a little bit of a complicated graph, but essentially what we have here is the radii of a root, of a typical root. That's the size. Down here we see the radii of a root hair. And then over here we see the radii of a vesicular arbuscular mycorrhizal hyphae. And you can see how much smaller that is. So in times of low soil moisture, the mycorrhizal hyphae are getting into places in the soil that still have moisture, and they're translocated back to the plant. And that's one of the reasons physically that we get drought tolerance. Another are these arbuscules that form inside of the colonized root cells. And these will actually hold moisture in times of drought and slowly release into the plant to keep it alive. An example of a drought tolerance study, this one done at the University of Florida. This was an inoculated quadrant. And what I find really, obviously untreated, you can see in drought what starts happening. But what I find really interesting, and I alluded to it earlier, is the mycorrhizal hyphae underground are moving across and creating this edge effect and beginning to colonize the field next to it. And you can see it up here as well. So these things do travel. Some mycorrhizae, I think up in Washington State, they've identified the same organisms, the largest living organism in the world, and they've checked it DNA-wise, and it's 325 miles across this hyphae from the same organism. So you can see in plant moisture stress conditions, the inoculated, non-irrigated, and the not-inoculated, you can see the difference in plant stress here, which is over 60%. So that's a big deal. 3 to 5 bars less plant moisture stress. If you're a golf course superintendent in San Diego and your irrigation goes out and your greens start dying before you can get your irrigation fixed, and that's another reason why you're seeing these things on golf courses, is it really gives you an insurance policy against any mechanical failures of irrigation. A study a number of years ago with our materials up at the University of Guelph in Ontario with transplant survival of perennial herbaceous plants showed that survival without mycorrhizae was down here about 40-45%. And the vast majority that were treated with mycorrhizae transplanted in drought conditions exceeded 70, most of them over around 80% survival. So a huge difference in the ability of plants to access moisture in drought conditions to keep the plant alive. Another one here done at the University of Rhode Island by Kosky, showing when wilt sets in, and mycorrhizal turf showed 39% less water stress, and after 8 days, 60% less drought stress. So that's a big deal. An example from some of our agricultural work, when the irrigation was shut off, you can clearly see this line of oats in this case. With the severe drought in California, they were cutting down a lot of almond trees, and obviously, if this drought persists, we wanted to know about almond trees and drought tolerance. And I think you can see the differences here are pretty dramatic in terms of the above ground and below ground biomass, the root system here. And this was, 6 weeks after no irrigation. And you can see this plant is still doing pretty well. This one's struggling, obviously, as a result of this as well. But really is a testament to the ability of mycorrhiza to resist drought.
Jim, is that applied as a liquid drench or something?
This particular one, I believe early on, these were dusted with our ultrafine powder, if I'm correct.
Oh.
Early on.
Oh, with planting, okay.
Yeah, when they were seedlings. And we've done, obviously, a lot with corn and soybeans and so forth. This actually was done at the University of Wisconsin. Corn plants survived 28% longer in drought conditions. This, I think, was from last year's National Geographic talking about the U.S. drought. Extreme, these dark areas. This has continued, obviously, into 15. They were talking about an El Nino coming in last year. That didn't happen. They're talking about it again this year. We'll see if that's going to happen. Hasn't happened yet. Regardless of what your views are on global warming, we obviously are experiencing climate change, whether that's temporary or extended, I think we're going to find out. But certainly mycorrhiza is a tool in drought relief. In terms of nutrient acquisition and nutrition, actually foliarly in plants, so we know the mycorrhiza is getting at all these micro and macronutrients. Let's look inside the food. Let's look inside the leaves and see that it's there. And this shows us in terms of applied fertility with Osmocote at a half and full rate, Osmocote being a slow-release horticultural-type fertilizer. And you can see that the differences in the non-mycorrhizal and mycorrhizal treatments in terms of these materials actually getting into the plant. So these are the type of things that scientists we like to look at. Improved nutrient uptake efficiency with phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, and calcium. You can see this was actually as a seed coat. In grass, we actually coated the grass seed and grew them out and analyzed the foliar content. We produce, we make a liquid endomycorrhiza that if you've ever seen Pennington grass seed, they're one of the biggest grass seed producers in Oregon. They actually have a seed called Smart Seed with Myco Advantage, and that's our liquid endo technology sprayed on that turf seed. And they're getting great results, and we calculated after a number of years of working with them that if we looked at how much that they produced and the average size of a residential lawn, and knowing that you can reduce water fertility 30%, we would have saved 22 billion gallons of fresh water, and the associated leachates that come out of those soils and end up in waterways, streams, and lakes. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. Here's an example of different types of phosphate, and mycorrhizal colonies actually showing them solubilizing and breaking down phosphorus. And reducing nitrogen and phosphorus leachates, as I alluded to with the turf Pennington grass seed example, we decided, you know, people said you can't grow corn organically. And we said, well, let's see if we can grow corn organically. So the organic corn on the left that can't be grown organically has the same organic concentration of as does chemical fertilizer. And then we wanted to look at the leachates associated. Now you can see here, because they've been able to dig in as the carbon decomposers and utilize this organic material and create this hyphal web in this bag, these are up on pallets above the ground. We collected all the water and leachates out of them. You can see this is what's not being utilized in plants. And in nursery and horticultural production, we did a study, I don't know, 15 years ago, with the EPA looking at Oregon nurseries and how much of applied fertility was actually getting into the plants. And a plant is only utilizing 7 to 15% of applied fertility. And we know where the rest of it was going. It was dropping right onto the floor of the greenhouses and going somewhere. And that's why you're starting to see these restrictions in landscape industries on phosphates and so forth. In terms of fertilizer utilization, you can see these plants over here receive 20 to 30% less fertility. And I think it's fair to say that they're at least as healthy or better than the plants on the left. So this is an idea, this is how the mycorrhizae can utilize applied fertility, either, you know, whether it's applied or out in, on site when you're planting materials. So no mycorrhizae, no fertilizer. Fertilizer only, and mycorrhizae and fertilizer. So fertilizers do enhance mycorrhizal colonization at certain levels. Fertilizers and organic materials help plants produce root activity, and in response to that root activity, the mycorrhizal spores germinate and become very aggressive. So you can actually use less mycorrhizae and more high-quality organics and get a really strong plant response. So talking about phosphorus, only about 15% is utilized. It's a non-renewable resource. The U.S. reserves will be used up by 2050. The Sahara has about 75% of the world's reserves, the U.S. about 2%. The world peak production for phosphorus is scheduled to be about 2035. So the importance of this is it's a non-renewable resource and we need phosphorus. So here's a tool to help us more wisely conserve and utilize the resources we have. Major problems linked to phosphorus, as you saw, the leachates, blue-green algae is being produced. We have hypoxia zones that the algae is creating, a lack of oxygen, so fish and food cannot live there. Creating lake. Here's a satellite photo, and this is the Gulf Coast. And this red area is where there's no oxygen in the water. There's also no fish here. You have to actually take a boat and go out about 30 miles to this area, and that's what it looks like. So you've got all this agricultural materials and fertility coming out of the Mississippi River, and this is what it looks like. And there's the algae, these algae blooms. So environmental benefits of mycorrhizae, you're capturing a lot of this material, reducing groundwater contamination, runoff. We're going to talk about erosion and glomalin. And it offsets global warming by sequestering atmospheric carbon, actually pulling it out of the atmosphere and holding it in the soil for up to 40 years. Some of the primary plant benefits, soil structure. Okay, so soil structure is important, air and water movement and so forth. So if you have good till and good aggregation, you get good water and air movement and your plants are going to do well. Here is one that does not have good till and aggregation. This right here is a plant root. And this substance right here that Dr. Mike saw for years out in the forest as he was a USDA researcher for 23 years, he saw this shiny stuff and he pulled up these little seedlings and he didn't really know what it was. Well, a number of years ago, an agricultural research scientist, Sarah Wright, determined and named this material glomalin. And
I get little shivers in my back because the only organisms that produce guamalin are the endomycorrhizal fungi. And she named it guamalin because of the guamalase group of microorganisms like in our product, Glomus irreatices, Glomus intubiculum, Glomus aggregatum, and Glomus mossiae. And so this substance holds 30% of the world's soil carbon in the soil for up to 40 years and actually sequesters it from the atmosphere. So if you believe in global warming or greenhouse gases, this is a way to offset those. You've heard of carbon credits. There may be a time not too distant that the government says, General Motors, you need to offset your carbon footprint. You need to go out and plant 100,000 acres of native grasses inoculated with endomycorrhizal fungi to offset your footprint. So it also, mycorrhizal produces polysaccharide glues that bind soil particles together, creating micro and macro spores. Increases water and air filtration. These are the glues that create stable soils. This is the type of soil that you start seeing when carbon builds up in it. There's a dark, crumbly texture. That's exactly the type of soil that you want to be growing plants in. So as to structure, you see these macro and micro pores for water and air movement. It also creates habitat for other microflora and fauna to live in the soil and create biodiversity and healthier soils. You can see here is a soil that has guamalin in it. You drop that into water and this is what happens. Okay, much less resistant to wind and water and rain erosion as compared to a non-mycorrhizal or non-guamalin soil. So that's a big deal because we're losing soil all the time by tillage. It's blown away in the wind. Running away in the rain, and after a few years of transitioning to a more organic, sustainable, biological soil approach, you can actually see your soils transforming and getting more into this crumbly type. So that's what can happen, and I don't know where a lot of your soils go, but I suspect a lot are mixed with native soils. Some are probably more sterile media-type soils that end up getting outplanted and mixing with native soils. And so to have some biology in them is going to make plants a lot healthier and certainly improve wherever they're planted. Let's see. So parasitic nematode control. Let's see. This is the Japanese horror flick. So there's a lot of nematodes, and some are beneficial and some are not. And these are the ones that aren't. So you have these nematodes, that's a hyphae, and the hyphae is actually forming these little nooses. And this is amazing. Here comes a nematode, and somehow there's a chemical messenger given off in these little hyphal nooses. And there's one being strangled over there. This guy, where is it? Okay. Well, you can see that they swing through these nooses, and then these little hyphal nooses actually inflate and strangle. So these are some of the mechanisms that nature uses, and these are the ones that we need to pay attention to and utilize to our advantage. And as a matter of fact, the company that acquired us is Valent Biosciences, and they do biorational technologies where they take a lot of these natural things and they combine them with some of the soft chemistries to kind of get the effect they're after without harming the soil and the environment as much. On the ectomycorrhiza, one of the disease-suppressing mechanisms is this fungal sheath that forms around the plant, making it much less permeable. Also, because mycorrhiza is a carbon decomposer and uses a lot of the food source in the rhizosphere and the mycorrhizosphere, there's not a lot of nutrients and food in this area around the root for other soil-borne pathogens to come in to get. So it's a direct competition for resources. Species diversity. You know, we have always been proponents that diversity rules, and I think you see that in nature. On the left, you have a single species product. On the right, you have a four species product. You can see how much better it's doing. If you look at the functions in terms of species, different mycorrhiza have different capacities, whether it's for nutrient uptake, root improvement, drought,
et cetera. So if you're, you know, creating a product that's just going to be used on palm trees, you want one that maybe that's really good for disease and sandy soils. These are the number of actual, I think these were studies, citations, documented and published peer-reviewed research on these different yield increase, nutrient uptake. So there's a ton of research and information out there regarding these. We talked about weed suppression. These are a partial list of important and common non-mycorrhizal weeds that people have to deal with. So if you can plant your target crop, you can get a jump start over these. There's a lot of work being done on cheatgrass invasion in the Pacific Northwest using mycorrhiza. The materials can be applied in different ways. We've got a whole host of different forms of mycorrhiza, powders, granulars, tablets, gels, powders, liquids, depending on how the applicator needs to use them. We use a lot of these in hydra seeding or grass seeding applications at the time of seeding. They can be blended right in the slurry for hydra seeding. Sod installation, they can be broadcast right below where the active roots are. Mixed in greenhouse medias, they can be sprayed on roots and transplanting, put in a planting hole. However you can most easily, with the least amount of labor, make contact with a plant root. And certainly putting them in soil products is a no-brainer because there they are. Your roots are right in there. As I mentioned, you know, there's an example of a seed there. You can put the powder on the seed. There's liquid technology. I can see liquids going on any of these colored bark and mulch materials. You can blend with dry fertilizers. Mycorrhiza doesn't like high available phosphorus, so slow release fertilizers, horticultural grade, are best. In the presence of high available P over 70 parts per million, the mycorrhiza won't germinate. And the reason why is because in nature, that's their job to go get these things. So if someone's doing your job, why get out of the bed in the morning and go to work? So they'll wait for those levels to drop below 70 parts per million, and then they'll colonize. So you're working against yourself because you're paying a bunch of money for phosphorus, you're paying money for mycorrhiza, and you don't need to be doing that. You can reduce your inputs of phosphorus. So in terms of other materials that are going into soil products like bacteria and trichoderma fungi, as I mentioned, some of the benefits of the mycorrhiza, they're not UV sensitive, the propagules are dormant, they're very stable in bags. We had to choose for registration, expiration dates, we chose 2 years. We warranty all of our products and the propagule counts, and actually the spore counts out to 2 years as labeled, and then there's a very slow decline after that. We say if you're using a product in year three, add 10%, year four, you'd add 20%, et cetera. The reality is it's much less than that, but and hopefully, you know, your products aren't out there for more than 2 years sitting on a shelf anyway. So some of the claims that can be made, that we've made substantiated, are better roots, getting at soil resources, they're accessing and absorbing nutrients, water. They absorb water and transport. We have a number of products out at Lowe's and Home Depot right now that say right on the bag you can use 30% less water. And I think you know that you can't just put that on a bag without being able to scientifically substantiate it, which we have. So could your products benefit from these things that we've been talking about? And if the answer is yes, and there's a product or a niche in what you guys are doing to include these products, I think it's important to mention that these things are not tremendously expensive per plant. As an example, an endomycorrhizal product, granular, 60,000 spores per pound, sells for about $6 a pound. And it takes 150 spores to colonize a 1 gallon plant. So you divide 60,000 by 150, and that's approximately how many 1 gallon plants you can treat with a pound. I think it's 300, but it's a lot. So you can see the affordability. Really, the placement of the material is as important as the rate of application. So if you can put it on seed, even one spore on a seed, and we've been proponents in terms of mycorrhiza standards to be able to compare one producer's mycorrhiza to another, of having a method whereby you actually literally place one spore on the same cultivar of corn, you grow that corn out, and then you do an MIP, mycorrhizal infection percentage, on it, you see how well that mycorrhiza performed. So there are standards available as an industry that I think the mycorrhizal people could really improve on and standardize so everybody knows what they're buying as consumers. And as producers, you know what you're paying for. Journal publications, a lot of them we've been in with our materials, a lot of third-party research from the universities. We have access to all of these, and also 100,000 studies on mycorrhizae and plants in our database. Some of the applications we talked about, access to the roots. As I mentioned, we have liquids, soluble powders. Some of these are agricultural products, a seed and furrow, 16 ounces treats 40 acres with 3.6 million spores. So we try to get out about 90,000 to 100,000 spores per acre with the seed at planting. That costs about $10 to $15. Very affordable when you can reduce water and fertility. So in conclusion, I would say that a happy root system is a happy plant. So with that, we are nature, and we need to start looking and exploring some of these biopossibilities in manufactured soil for our disturbed environments. So thank you all for being here, and thank you guys for allowing me to be here.
Questions?
Yes.
So once you introduce this into the media, what type of replenishment do you have to do over time?
What type of what?
Like, what type of replenishment over time? Like, let's say we inoculate today, when does that become less effective over
right.
time?
Well, consider that, these particular fungi, a lot of people ask us for compost teas because they're growing bacteria, they're growing, mycorrhizae. You don't grow mycorrhizae, only the plant grows it. So it's totally dormant in a spore form until it comes in contact with the root. So it's going to stay there. Like I mentioned, we've seen some cutbacks in Wisconsin where some of these spores are 10,000 years old and they're totally viable. We did a lot of testing early on when we started doing soil products in terms of temperatures. Like if some of these bag products were out at, Lowe's or whatever in the parking lot on black asphalt. So on a 100-degree day, we took a 40-pound bag of mulch, we put our mycorrhizae incorporated in it, and we put little computer probes throughout that bag. And we actually, every hour, it measured the temperature in that bag. And, because mulch is also an insulator, the temperature on a 100-degree day never got above about 85. And you need to get to about 140 to actually harm the spores. So they're really very durable and long-lasting. So, we're doing some more research on liquid incorporation for liquid fertilizers. Right now, we're real comfortable with about a year. It really depends what other materials are incorporated in those liquid fertilizer products. We're seeing a little bit of spore germination between year one and year two. And so the idea is that we add more at the front end, so when those things occur, we've got it covered in terms of application rates and viability.
So how about, once you've inoculated it, how about propagating it within a hydroponic system? Can it regenerate like that, or
I'd share this information with you, but I'd have to kill you.
Only into a root. I mean, when you say they're completely dormant.
Yeah. Well, we produce our mycorrhizae just generally in two ways. One is in association in vivo, in life, with a living plant host. And then we harvest the soil and we extract the mycorrhizae and use that in our inoculants. The new technology is in vitro, which is, in a bioreactor in the Danforth Plant Sciences building, where we just grow the root, and we don't grow the plants, so we extract the spores off of the root. And that's really nice because we have a kind of sterile environment where we can limit any exposure to any kind of pathogens. The other advantage is it's 24/7. Once you get it going in the bioreactor, you have a steady flow coming out the other end. The other big advantage is in the past, our most concentrated product was 130,000 spores per pound, and recently we've gotten up to 1 million per gram. So in terms of shipping this stuff to South America, and why a company like Valent Sumitomo Chemical was interested in buying our company is we, instead of sending 10,000 pounds, we can now send a 2-pound overnight box anywhere in the world. So it's really changed the whole complexity of the industry.
So the short answer, it does not propagate in water.
Correct. Water and temperature do not activate mycorrhizal spores.
So you can't, okay, and how about feeding them simple sugars like in the lab?
You don't feed them, plants feed them, so.
Very important.
Yeah, they're very good.
That is.
Yeah. Yes?
Could you clarify what you said? You said that the mycorrhizae won't activate if they're in an environment over 70 parts per million available phosphate, is that what you said?
That is correct.
So, what, I mean...
Available phosphate, and that's different than having, a, you know, 70 parts per million in your soil. It's actually availability at the plant root. It's got to be available. There's a whole different mathematical equation. So, you know, typically what we find in agriculture is that's about 5 pounds per acre of pea liquid.
So a typical garden soil or potting mix that's got fertilizer added be way over that threshold, and so the mycorrhizae wouldn't activate?
Well, you know, I don't think so, because you're going to take that fertilizer, you're going to put it out somewhere, mix it with other soil, you're going to put it out with a plant, and it's not going to be available at the plant root where those chemicals are being produced. And the bottom line, once again, as coming from the science company, is we would take that material and we would apply it to plants, as you're going to expect a purchaser to. But I think what you're going to find is you're not going to be anywhere near that kind of availability. That would cost a lot of money for a soil product if you had 70 parts per million available in every piece of that where a plant is going to be planted. So, but you're right. If in fact it is, that it's going to delay germination until those P levels drop below 70 as they, you know, buffer out into the adjoining soil and bulk material, and then they'll colonize. And like I said, because you get branching and early, you know, morphological benefits and disease suppression, you really don't want to delay it. You're better off reducing the peak and using, you know, native natural soil biology to do that job for you. Yes?
Hey, golf courses use this for weed Bermuda areas and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Did you say for weed?
Bermuda.
Yeah, for Bermuda grasses, absolutely. All the C3 and C4 grasses are highly mycorrhizal. They colonize really aggressively. As a matter of fact, we use some grass species in the production of our in vivo mycorrhizal that are particularly aggressive. And all the turf grasses are highly mycorrhizal. You know, the challenge on golf courses, obviously, is you've got USGA specs, you've got a lot of sand, you've got a lot of drainage, and you don't have a lot of roots, particularly on greens. So you're dumping on a lot of fertility, and you're dumping in, and then you're in a warm climate, and you create disease issues, and then you got to get more chemicals on there, and you get into this death spiral that you're stuck in, and you can't get out of. So utilizing mycorrhizae, expanding root systems on greens, you know, you may get more top growth than you want, but some of the species, you know, don't allow that. So that, you know, you have to find that combination where you can actually retain the applied water and not have it dry out as quickly and not have that water out there to create other disease issues. Anybody else? Thank you all very much. Have a great day.